And I welcome all of you here tonight. We are a little bit bound by time, and that's not always fun at a poetry reading, because we like to just be more open-ended. But the Women's Circle around the fire out by Narnia is happening just a little after 10. And I know that there may be people here who want to go to that, so we want to make that possible for you. We are 10 of us, and Beverly is just coming in the door after scooping ice cream. I think we'll read in this, Beverly, we got a chair for you. I think we'll read in this order, and we'll take about 5 minutes each and see where it comes down, if we have any other time. And you can introduce yourself just beforehand. This is the open poetry reading, and welcome.
I am Margaret Ponder Lovejoy. I write poetry and also short stories, fictional short stories. I guess I would like to have more time to write, but I don't seem to have enough time to write, or I don't make enough time to write. But this is a collection that Carolyn helped me put together 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that. That I try to get it together to have it ready for the bookstore this year, but hopefully next year I'll have it together for the bookstore. And since this is Multicultural Diversity Week, I'll read this one first. And it's called, "And Mother Africa Cries for All Her Lost Daughters." Black kinky-haired babies no longer are born from her womb. Now brown babies fall from her swollen belly. Most are sold off to the highest bidder. Her milk-filled breasts are used to nourish the master's babe. Her breasts sag, and she no longer cares who suckles. She cries for the love of Mother Africa. Scrubbing floors and cooking in someone else's kitchen with her head tied in a greasy bandana, she keeps her eyes lower so as not to seem uppity or out of her place. And Mother Africa cries. Africa's daughter looks for beauty in Vogue and Cosmopolitan magazine. She sees blue eyes, silky hair, thin lips. The reflection in her mirror tells the story of her ancestors. She tries to mold her beauty to someone else's expectation, and Mother Africa's tears are ignored. Black power, she learns to appreciate what she has, that she is and what she can be. Wrapped in the aura of black presence, Lucy, her foremother, kindred spirit, family of origin, take hold of her soul. She falls in love with all that has ever been, and Mother Africa smiles. Just as I am, would that I could resculpt myself. Would I change a single piece of me? Would I change my hands of standing veins and wrinkled skin and uneven nails? Would I rid myself of bloated belly that once held my children safe and secure? The belly that is the center of my womanhood, the belly that feels so soft and warm rubbing against my lover. Would I change my legs to be more shapely, these legs that have taken me through fields of smiles and unexpected happiness, legs that have guided me through stages and places that were new to me. Would I change my face, restructure my nose, slim my lips, change the shape of my eyes? Would I destroy the features of my beautiful blackness? I need me just as I am. I've been sculpted by God, breathed upon by loving artists. No one has the right to change me, and I have no right to change me. I need me just as I am. Then the last one I'll read is my fun poem, the spinach poem. Eating spinach all my life, munching, crunching spinach leaves, green, fresh spinach. Ate no peas, ate no corn, only ate spinach leaves, green, fresh, sometimes gritty, gritty spinach leaves. Didn't look left, didn't look right, stayed on course all my life, always eating spinach, iron-rich spinach leaves, good-tasting spinach leaves. Didn't travel, didn't wander, didn't wander, wore my hair short, wore my clothes long, wasn't faddish, wasn't sleek. Always ate my spinach leaves, good for me, green spinach leaves. On my job, I worked it well, but never seemed to excel. Doesn't matter what the hell, as long as I eat my spinach leaves. Ever-present spinach leaves. Good for me, green spinach leaves. That's my life now, narrow and small. It lacks luster, I can tell. But I ate my spinach leaves. Good for me, spinach leaves. And in the end, what can I see? Lots and lots of green, green shit.
Is that a medical term? Let's see. I can't read several poems, but I only have one.
Who are you?
I'm Chuck Pump.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. And I don't write poetry. I write journal articles, and I won't read you any of those, for which you'll be thankful. This I wrote Monday, and I gave it to Karen, and she made some wonderful comments on it, and I even used some of them. But blame me for it. Title is John Lee Hooker, and for those of you who don't know, he's a blues singer. Florida, August 1972. I lay on my mattress on the floor, the air close like the bad breath of a good friend. John Lee Hooker, on the record player, picked his guitar and growled at the groove. Hooker whined about his woman who left him because all he did was drink. I drank with him Jack Daniels in an iced tea glass. It would burn on the lump in my throat as I rested, and Hooker complained about work that was too hard and long and scarce. His record's gone now, like the bourbon. Some damn fool stole the player and the record on top, too. I dabbled in the blues then, borrowed it from experts. I knew the small loneliness of hitching in the rain without a hat, or hiking on the gravel by the highway, or sleeping on the tile in an all-night public bathroom. This light loneliness introduced me to John Lee Hooker's complaints about traveling. He was always leaving, tossed out in the night, stealing away. Here comes the change. The guitar pauses for the line, "My baby's left me." Now the savory, smoky loneliness I borrow is a pain I cannot feel. My heart's not ground so fine as Hooker's. My lines don't rhyme and slide in rhythm. When I try to grasp this absence as I sit or sleep or shave, my thoughts slip away and mumble and limp and are filled in by commercial jingles. What fool would make a beer that looks like tap water? So now I'll get my records out and listen to John Lee Hooker complain about his baby. The rhythm and the words, and the growling and the grumbling and the grief. These will hold my sadness captive for a long, licking inspection.
My name is Art Spurrell, and I write poetry sometimes, and it's usually a window into my soul, and sometimes my soul is happy and sometimes it is sad. And once I wrote a poem called Izzy Kazoo. It is especially designed for small children. It goes, "There's a make-believe land called Izzy Kazoo where I can go and so can you. Just cross your fingers and close your eyes, count up to 10 and back to 5, and soon you'll be in Izzy Kazoo. You'll find little green kittens and polka dot bears, long striped and twigglies with purplish hair. They'll rush out to greet you and then start to play. You'll have a very nice time, and so will they. You'll play hide and seek and come and ride over cops and robbers in the four-leaf clover. You'll be so busy having so much fun that the day will be over before it's begun. And then you'll come home to your own room and bed, crawl under covers and rest your tired head. You'll be so sleepy that rest will soon come and the night will be over before it's begun. This is what happens in Izzy-Kazoo, where I can go and so can you. Just cross your fingers and close your eyes. Count up to 10, back to 5, and soon you'll be in Izzy-Kazoo. It's a wonderful little place. Then once upon a time, when Eric was about 18 months old, he had been diagnosed as having missing part of the chromosome. There are all sorts of really negative things. And I wrote a projection poem. It's what's it going to be like when Eric is 5 years old? And this is what I wrote. My little boy is 5 years old and he ain't walking yet. My little boy is trying though and I love him, oh you bet. He comes to me most every night when I come home at 5. I pick him up and swing around. Thank God that I'm alive. He's got a mom that loves him so, and his sister Cindy too. Without their love, oh my God, I don't know what he'd do. He's struggling with his handicaps, he's trying to fit in. Don't burden him with yours, kind one, please help him to fit in. My little boy is 5 years old, and he ain't talking yet. My little boy is trying though, and I love him, oh you bet. Other kids may laugh at him and tease him all the time. The ridicule, it hurts him so. But the hurt is also mine. If kids and moms and dads could know the love that's in his heart, they'd treat him with the tenderness right from the very start. He's struggling with his handicaps. He's trying to fit in. Don't burden him with yours, kind one. Please help him to fit in. And if I would have time for another one? Mm-hmm. This is called Jonathan Blackman, and it's appropriate 43. And when I'm done, I'm going to give you the sheets because I told you last year I'd give it to you and I didn't send it to you. Jonathan Blackman is true to his name, often defiant though never in shame. Jonathan Blackman is more than a name. Jonathan Blackman was born in the South with hunger extreme. He lived hand to mouth. That's the way it was for a child of the South. But John, he had luck. Pluck, guidance, and love. With lots of hard work, he rose up above his humble beginnings on wings of a dove. The flight was not certain, he did nearly die, was hurt to the core, but never would cry when the hue of his skin gave reason to fly from the bigotry, hatred, taunting disgrace of being a member of God's darker race. But John had the courage these falsehoods to face. And face him he did from Detroit to Jackson with Rosa, with Martin, Ralph, Andrew, and Jackson. The civil rights movement was finally in action. John was the first through the white school's front door, then just 2 years later was in the Nam War, came home purple-hearted, silver-starred, and more. With finished degrees years later, he went to the doors of the corporate establishment and found there the color line, not broken, not bent. Jonathan Blackman was persistent for sure. His performance was flawless. His record was pure. Was promoted in 6, while others 3 fewer. John is much older now, older than time. He's long paid his dues and waited in line. His children are growing. His youngest is 9. Please tell me, dear people, will Jonathan's son have to now fight old battles already won? Will we turn back time so wars be begun? Or will we at last leave conflict behind and accept now these people for what's in their mind, for what's in their heart? Will we look there to find? Or just like our fathers, look only to skin, never ask for their friendship nor look there within to not change this pattern, 'tis the gravest cold sin. So when you see Jonathan's children at play, at work, at the grocery, by night or by day, please think of the premium that they've had to pay. They paid it in person or paid on account by eons of pain. God knows the amount. They've paid it with blood and tears you can't count. So reach out your heart, hand opened up mind, help break down the chains that now can still bind. Share then of yourself, and a true friend you'll find. Perhaps you will learn the lesson John taught. The make of a person, their skin tells you not. The make of a person's in their heart to be sought. Yes, Jonathan's skin's black outside and in. For mine it is white, lily white as a fin, yet to Jonathan Blackman I'm next of kin, and so are you. Thank you.
My name is David Moore, and I am a tape minister maniac. to tell you a bit about this poem, I was it's so funny. There was two older people had come up to demonstrate how to do the old-fashioned polkas and shashas of these Scandinavian countries, and they were very funny people in their 70s, I'm sure, and just totally into it. Like the costumes were original and very old. And so this man who was teaching, I can't remember his name. I think I'll call him like Nels or something. So he has given me this case, vinyl case of cassette tapes to play at different times during their instruction time. And there's like 12 tapes for 4 dances or something. So I'm like up there, up in this trying to figure out, now how the hell am I going to know when he wants to move on or repeat it and so he's like, him and his wife are like down there totally trying to communicate with me to like redo it or do half of it as an intro. So he's like down there, arms akimbo, and
let's rewind that, please, one more time.
Anyway, I got through it, chewed off some fingernails, but that's okay. It was just hilarious. It was just fantastic. I had an excellent time. Anyways, they're and watching people dancing during this, I came up with a little ditty here. So it's called Sculling Hot, and Carolyn Horner has graciously printed it out in huge letters. It's like, I can be sure and see it, I think. Anyways, okay. Sculling Hot. Polkas, shoddish, ways to see you beyond the realms of thoughts. Confusion of to follow, to lead. Who is my partner? How do we know? Faith leads us to the unknown, pursuing you, laughing, teasing, letting our guards down to see our light. Then away, not hot, but scolding, to turn the heat off. Cool this down, our bodies, our feelings too hot to handle. Away to bed, single file, to think and become entrenched with the ideas of boundaries, opposites, and similarities. Who wants to be so hot that it melts the ideal of excitement and the raw, pure feelings?
Thank you. I'm Tom Thorsheim, and I've just got several pieces here, but they're really short. They're just kind of sketches, so just kind of little bits. And most of them don't have titles, so assume they don't have titles unless I say so. Okay, first one. Torn geranium terrace spills through shattered walls of glass. Spineless salamanders slither into crevices and corners of darkness. And the second one. Meditation. Ragged water tumbling over rounded stone. Sidetracked channels swirl into reflecting eddies of smooth calm. A granite dais projects from midstream. Listening from this sun-soaked perch, thunderous nothingness takes me on a wander. And then the third one is called Paradise. Aqua yellow-green watercolor swirls, spring sunlight, copsy-sweet magnolias and passionate caresses reveal earthly paradise. Long strands of tangled and tousled hair fall over your face, hair jostled and messed up from rolling down hills. Parting your hair, you kiss me playfully. I laugh and gently nip your earlobe. Then this fourth one is called Subway. On the subway, people erect fortresses of newspaper. They sit tightly within their own separate realities. Taut indifference exudes from pursed lips, diverted eyes. By periodically glancing at their oh-so-accurate quartz timepieces, they dig moats around their fortresses. Then the next one. Wandering, walking swiftly, aimlessly, with precision and determination. Checking his watch, the time of day provides stability, regularity. Then let's see. Receding forward in silent motion is the name of the next piece. Cars pass my bedroom window in the night. My wall acts as a projection screen, catching silhouettes of twigs and twigs and gnarled branches. Shadows flip silently backwards as the light flies past. Here's another one without a name. Weighty smiles freely thrown with heart skipping momentum. Our eyes throw longing gazes. They meet, but quickly roll away like magnets which pull and push the engines of emotion. Here's another one. Some days I think I know, other days I know I don't. The smells of earth, smells of rain. The smell of resin and camphor of old railroad ties baked in the sun. The stickiness of the pine I climbed when I was six. I don't think the pitch ever did come out. Hiding my head in your hair, I kiss your nose, you kiss my chin. And then this last piece is just, it's just kind of a nonsense piece that I wrote. It's just kind of I just like the sounds of it. It doesn't make any sense at all, so don't try to figure it out. Petunia salamander marches greenly in the suave silicon of sand in an hourglass. The almighty newt slithers, withers, and wanders with no curds of whey, nor a dog with a bone, nor a spider which sat right beside her.
I'm Beverly Bolseth, and I'm teaching the writing class, and I'll be here till the 27th, so I welcome anyone that would like to come and participate. You don't have to be a writer. You can just come and have some of the fun that we have during that time. This first one is called April. When pussy willows wade blooming in the water by the roadside nobody owns, I spend all day on the dirt highway tasting the cold wind, thinking of everything, wanting the first flower of spring inside my eye. All day my body asks for this. Dark lakes grow larger from the night rain, today's snow melting among cattails, the leaf rot. Across the swimming golf course, beyond the condos, a vast white lake will hold firm for two more weeks. Ice fishermen persist at holes far back in the marina. In the green rubber boots covered with mud are these happy feet. And this one is dedicated to people of a certain age. If you're that age, you'll know what it is. It's called Clashing Glasses. You know those moments. You've been with this person all day and it's time. You want to feel those lips over yours. Finally, the moment is just right. She's ready, you can tell, you are close, you turn to each other. The perfect movie shot. Courting has been so long ago, but there it is, Your lips almost touch, but the corner of her glasses locks with yours, and you are caught. You disengage the rims with laughter, the moment gone. But no, she takes her glasses off and turns to you again. You take yours off too. When you remember this days later, you will know this is when ecstasy began. And then I have a chapbook in the bookstore, very cheap, $3. I will read you a couple of poems from that. This one is called Poem for My Father. After you were dead a year, I wrote a short story about you, and then I felt better. None of it was true. You never told me anything, so I made it up. I never asked you anything, but that escaped me for years. 25 years later, in a Wisconsin farmhouse far away from the flat South Dakota land where you met my mother, voices tell me to grieve. I can't fix the day of your funeral. Was it hot? Did many people come? Can't remember what your casket was like, what you were like, your head on a satin pillow. Or did they show you at all? Did we have coffee and cake after? Hot dish maybe, for those who travel far? We drove 400 miles home that same day. I always dated a picture of my youngest by the funeral. She's on my sister's porch in a Charles Atlas pose, diaper hanging below her stomach. My journal says we left her at the neighbor's back in Minnesota. Nothing is right. Nothing agrees. My daughters never knew you. I don't remember you ever holding them. I don't ever remember you holding me. I didn't ever hold you. Finally, I know what this grief is. And this one is called Margie. On summer Saturdays, Margie Lewis and I made Campbell's tomato soup in her cockroach-crawling kitchen, carried it in a fruit jar to the cemetery across Cherry Rock Bridge, played on the mound of discarded grave decorations, salvaged satin ribbons, plastic flowers, drank our soup in the shade of a bur oak. Margie lived further from school than I, but she was always waiting when I came out our basement house door. Her hand covered her nose when she talked to me, her face turned red. On the long walk to school, she trailed behind me, sometimes stepping on my heels. Who else walked with me? I can't remember. Maybe Geraldine Smeltzer, maybe my brothers. We were a gang of us. She wanted only to be my friend, would do anything for me, believe anything. I gave her a mothball from my coat pocket, told her it was candy. She put it in her mouth, choked some, spit it out. The rest of us all laughed hard. So this is what I am, I who have spent my whole life wanting to be loved. And then the last one, for the skeptics. You say you don't believe people can rise from the dead. Believe. There is life after death, any number of them, for I am alive. I won't tell where the sojourn was. Some of you listening know. I see the resurrected light in your eyes. I see the newly living glow around your body. Some of you have been there. Do not look back. 100 starlings have just left the dark maple. Rain is caught in the spider's web. Light glistens on the hair of your arm. Air sliding through your nostrils swells the whole chest. When you open your mouth, it rushes out in one long Yahoo!
I'm Mark Kremen Teal, Squamish tribe, and I have a sort of a generic story of more or less ecology and environmental awareness. I had written this right before coming to Holden about 4 weeks ago. It's Father Sky coming down to talk to Mother Earth. And Father Sky comes down as droplets this time. And Mother Earth doesn't feel Father Sky at first, and so he has to bring down more droplets down to Mother Earth, and whitecaps the mountain of Mother Earth. And as the snow melts, it ends up, it trickles down the mountain and talks to the trees. The trees hear the droplet, stand there, ask Mother Earth what has been going on around on Mother Earth. And the tree bends down and looks at the droplet and says, "Oh, things are going so-so." And the droplets trickle down, further down the mountain. And the rocks, the grandfathers of the land, are the next encounter the droplets meet. And the mountain, only ground to the droplets, ends up, and the droplets have to record all the language that comes from Mother Earth, for they are going back to Father Sky to give the message of what Mother Earth has been doing lately. Ubets, the Native American word for salmon, is the next encounter that the droplets encounter, and the droplets ask, how are things going on around Mother Earth? And the old salmon, old King Salmon, just moans, and again says, "What's wrong?" And he says, "Well, you'll see later on. The deer, the bear, the squirrel, other animals have been asked the same questions as the droplet goes down the mountain. And further on, it reaches a big wall. All the droplets are stopped at one place. They have no place to go. And they stop and they're wondering, what's wrong? They look up, and there's a big wall right in front of them. They cannot go anywhere. Ends up, all of a sudden, each droplet are swished down and going into a big turbine that goes around and around. They get hot and then they get spit out and they fall way down to Mother Earth again. And it ends up, they're all confused, and another salmon falls on top of the droplet's heads. I stood there and the droplet asked, "What's wrong? What happened?" And the poor salmon stood there and tells the droplets they cannot get home. There's a big wall that's in their way and they cannot go home. So it ends up, the droplets ask, what can we do? It ends up, we have to ask an eagle to come down and talk to us and give us some information to help us know what's going wrong. So they all yell, stammering, saying, yell up to the eagle, "Oh, eagle, come down, help us. Help us find out what's going wrong." And the eagle perches down on alongside the water and talks to the droplets and says, "There's another animal that has come down and it has been part of Mother Earth. They have two legs and they have not respected Mother Earth." It ends up, they say that we have to start listening to the animals and the plants and start respecting Mother Earth. If not, Mother Earth will not exist. And the droplets, before they get down to the sea, will stand there and go back up to Father Sky to give the news of what has been happening around Mother Earth. I talking to Rebecca before Karen and David ended up, she had mentioned that I should read this poem. She enjoyed this. I had written "O Great Spirit, whose breath gives life to the world, and whose voice is heard in the soft breeze. We need your strength and wisdom. May we walk in beauty. May our eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make us wise so that we may understand what you have taught us. Help us to learn the lessons you hidden in every leaf and rock. Make us always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes. So when life fades as the fading sunset, we may come to you without shame. Thank you.
My name is David Wee. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I am a college English teacher and administrator and a distance runner and a baseball fan. Not always in that order of importance or skill. And I'm what's called an occasional poet, in both senses of the word occasional. I write poetry only occasionally instead of regularly. And usually when I do, it's in honor of some occasion, a birthday or a retirement or something like that. I'm going to read two poems. The first one is from a medley of poems that I wrote on the occasion of the Minnesota Twins winning the 1987 World Series.
Spiritual event.
Yes, it was. And all of these poems are parodies of well-known British and American poems. I used some of the language and the rhythms and the shapes of some of these poems. The one I'll read to you is will make more sense to you if you're familiar with T.S. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, because it's based, you'll hear the echoes of that poem in this one. This one is called The Glove Song of Our Kirby Puckett. Let us go then, you and I, to where the ceiling is spread out against the sky like a canvas igloo that has started to melt and sag in the warming sun. Let us leave the half-deserted skyways and one-way streets that lead like a tedious argument to the overwhelming question. In the dome, the women come and go, talking of Joe DiMaggio. The little guy who plants his back against the center field wall, who crosses himself whenever he comes to bat, who licks his tongue at every chance to hit and every chance to catch a long fly ball or throw a runner out at third. All summer long, our Kirby has gone to the fence, made a sudden leap, and brought us to these soft October nights. In the dome, the men, too, come and go, talking of Joe DiMaggio. And indeed, there will be a time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare to leave my seat and descend the stair to the bathrooms and the brats and nachos stand? With a bald spot in the middle of my hair and my white World Series sweatshirt on my chest, to buy another beer and take the risk of missing one of Kirby's magic grabs. In the dome, the women and men come and go, talking of Joe DiMaggio. And whether Kirby might be a better fielder, and in time even a better batter than old Joe. I have measured out my life with frosty malt spoons. Amidst the organ music that almost wrecks this place for human habitation. And I have known the arms already, known them all. DiMaggio's, Pafko's, Aaron's, Clemente's, Barfield's. Is it mustard from a brat that makes me so digress? It makes me so digress from Kirby's marvelous glove, which, after all, as the title reveals, is what this poem is supposed to be about. I should have had a pair of seats in section 105 to see up close Kirby gliding across the floor of this green sea. It is impossible to say just what I mean. No, I am not Sid Hartman, or even his close personal friend, full of high sentences. I'm a bit abstruse. I grow old. This poem grows long. What was that overwhelming question anyway? And should I then presume? And how should I begin? I should have begun like this. What would we have done without Kirby's glove? Could the twins have come from the dead without it? Is there a better outfielder in all of baseball? And how should I then conclude? How about this? In the dome, the people come and go, talking no more of Joe DiMaggio, but only of Kirby Puckett and his glove. That is what I meant, after all.
David, I thought for a moment there that you were going to say that in the women come and go talking about Joe DiMaggio, the men come and go talking about Marilyn Monroe.
And then I'll read a briefer one, more serious one that I wrote, class here at Holden back in June, and this one is called Reflections. We put our mirrors in all the wrong places, above the bathroom sink, inside the purse, at the door where we come in or leave, in the car to see where we have been. We want to see the me that others see. We want to see our face so we can fix it. We want to put the tie or hem aright. The mirrors help us set our public face. We should take all these mirrors down and put them up where we will see our soul. Within our lover's eyes, our children's heart, between the bread and wine, upon the cross, and last of all, somewhere behind, so we can see not where our body's been, but where our soul is bound.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Horner, and I am the editor here. As of about officially a week ago. I think I'm going to read four. Is that true? Or am I cheat a little? And do one more. Sometimes something that comes out of the imagination is real tangential. The majority of the stuff that I write is basically, a window to the soul sort of a thing. But sometimes it's real tangential, and I don't even understand why it happens. And this is one of them. It's called Street Person with a Knife. Man with the face of a new quarter moon with question marks in his eyes. Passes by in a cloud of sad, singing a strange song like a death dirge directed at the skies. Old dirty baggy pants, shoes worn through dragging steps of despair, long raggedy hair partially veiling the strange concavity of his face, he turns his burning eyes inward to stare. Life of leisure, devoid of pleasure, life of lonely, lulled by liquor. Never does he consider a second chance. God, he roars, why hast thou forsaken me? And angels of the devil lean in to kiss his whiskied lips. Seduced, he relinquishes his last excuse for life and ends it quickly with an old rusty knife. In When the heck was that? August of 1991, the writing department was eliminated at the company that I was a writer for. And so I was on unemployment for a year because writers weren't a real hot, marketable thing during the course of that year. 91-92 is pretty rough. I wrote this, it's called The End of July, Unemployment Blues, 1992, because as it unfolds, the next month they were pulling the plug. Guess what, son of a gun, ain't gonna have a cent to my name come August 31. Got a dog in my stomach, keeps chasing his tail, and the only thing that comes in the mail is bills, 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 and rejection, relentless rejection. Damn it, how'd I get so low? Made my fears my king and queen, my sovereigns of suffering. Down on my knees with downcast eyes, spirit broken in fragments, I beg them to set me free. But my king and queen cackle heartlessly because they got the best of me. Yes, sir, they got the best of me. This is called The End. He called me up drunker than a skunk. He told me he was clean in his anger. I told him, no, he got dirty in it. He said he knew himself better than I. I said, bottom line, I can't take the strain. He said, okay, goodbye. Okay, goodbye. Love me tender, love me true, let's part now before I hate you. Okay, goodbye. Okay, goodbye. Wildly in love. Karen and David's kid, Rebecca, is the one that in a class had us be cranking out these things. And I showed up for one, and this is what happened. She said, imagine that you're wildly in love. Or no, just write a poem about being wildly in love. Well, I had to go back a few years, but this is what happened. Eyes engulf me. Caution whispers in a voice I choose to ignore. Mind magnetizes, drawn fully in one direction only. I memorize the contours, the freckles, the laughs, the desires. Life brims over and friends notice the frenzy of torrential serenity. I am beautiful, bounding recklessly into love and high on the free fall. This will be the last one. It's called Fire in Her Memory. Middle-aged woman resting on a shelf, gathering layers of dust on herself. Passive and gray with waning memories of lust, her fear of fading away numbed by the ice of apathy. Young man, barely 18, sporting a coat of testosterone dreams, passes her by and stops with a look that licks her insides with fire. She flutters on the shelf, clouds dust on the rise, settling in a blessed blanket, opaquing her eyes, her heart, her thighs. Come clean, said he, come be with me. But the middle-aged woman's hearing obscured to maintain her security. Settled in her dust, nestled on the shelf, the woman fades in shades of gray. Yet she sizzles as she cools in the twilight.
Stark right hand and turn from that tone. My name is Karen Herseth Wee, and I love open poetry readings. It's such amazing examples and differences and journeys inward that are revealing. David and I, some years ago, had the great good fortune to travel with 30 students on a global trip at St. Olaf College for 5 months. And I ended up writing some pieces from that. And because of the Multicultural Diversity Week, I wanted to read from those poems to honor what we've been thinking about and what we've been doing this week. So these are more serious. And usually, my eye and my heart was caught by situations of women. The very first poem I'll read has to do with my great good fortune of having a passport at all. And I can feel really moved by that. I mean, I don't know. It's a very magical thing to have a piece of paper with a number on it that allows you to come and go from other people's countries and lets you back into your own. So this is called A Pass. Bombay could have been home, or Jerusalem. I could carry guns along the barbed fence in the Golan, or wear tattooed numbers on the soft inside of my arm. Instead, a small blue book, number 07057511, graces my name. This one is just called India. In the desert world, water is better than gold. So rare, you taste it in sleep, slosh it on the tongue, push it through the gaps of your teeth, dribble it over dry lips to the chin. It slides smoothly down throats, inside or out, even when putrid, even when diarrhea comes. Women deliver it. They walk miles for water. Hoisted precariously up to their heads in containers of brass, copper, or clay, then trudged toward their families, the weight of it pushing their feet in the dust. Pottery women, their breakable flesh carrying water more rare than gold. This is just a moment of watching Muslim women swimming in the Mediterranean. They wait to go into the water either very early in the morning before anyone else is up, or at the very end of the day when no one else is there, and they swim in their clothes. The Mediterranean, an immense turquoise tossed on white sand, its veins the black robes of Bedouin women swimming.
Why don't you read that once more?
The Mediterranean, an immense turquoise tossed on white sand, its veins the black robes of Bedouin women swimming. The turquoise stone with the dark strands in it. Mm-hmm. And we were in India for Halloween. It was Halloween. I went to the vegetable market in Bangalore, India for squash. She followed me from the street to every food stall and back to the street again. I could buy nothing. Her hands were bound, feet too. I cannot tell you now the details because I couldn't really look. She had leprosy. On a cart in the street, her husband held a daughter waiting. I think it was a daughter. They too had leprosy. I couldn't really look. On the street, they followed me. She touching at my elbow with her bound hand, I kept walking, not looking down, kept walking with the friend Dinshaw whom I'd come with. He explained, do not give her anything. They make enough money begging, some of them, to give their children college educations. This one, I said, this one. We rounded them all up once, he said, brought them to a clean place of 3 meals a day, a cot, got them off the streets. They wouldn't stay, you know, could make more money begging, give her nothing. This one, I thought, as she pleaded with her eyes through our car window, now holding her ragbound child swaddled close, her husband on a wooden cart behind her. He had been turning its wheels frantically with his stumpy hands to catch us before our car pulled away. I bought nothing. I gave nothing either. We returned to Dinshaw's home, to its cool marble tiled floors. And the last one I'll read is called Hiroshima, and it was written because of the friendship of a Japanese man there who took us home for supper and told us stories about his life. Hiroshima. I have stood on the spot of the falling bomb. The Enola Gay shadow must have seemed a giant bird coming in that day, or an angel leaving. I stood in the cold of a January day trying to imagine heat like that. Even the museum holding a man's shadow burnt into cement bank steps cannot tell of heat like that. A Japanese friend has brought me here, a man who was a boy in this city. He knew its alleys, the shortcuts, a good place to fish at the river, where to stand to wave goodbye the longest to his father, a Navy ship captain who came and went from the harbor and one day did not return. That man's mother has lived on alone 50 more years. My Japanese friend has not returned to Hiroshima for many years. Today he stands beside me and we touch the stone-cold monument dressed in origami cranes, colored like blessings. He smiles, says he remembers only two things, being hungry for food, being hungry for books, always hungry. I've met his sons. They are tall. I tell him how fine and tall his sons are, ask him if they had a tall grandfather or mother. He says no, hesitates, just food in their growing years. I have stood in the place of the falling bomb with this man, a poet, a writer, a Zen master who translates English novels into Japanese, who loves Gary Snyder, and knowing him just for this while is my blessing. Thank you very much.